Okay, welcome back. I'm Michael Slayton. What you're going to hear now is the first excerpt of an extended interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this interview, this is the last segment of the interview, and I felt it was really important to run it today because of the proximity to the, well, basically because of all the turmoil and all the focus on the elections and how should people who are progressive people who are revolutionary-minded, people who want to get fundamental change, how should they be relating to this? So let's get into the interview, and after we're done, we will be taking your calls for the rest of the hour. This is Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Well, let's talk about this, because right now, I mean, there's a, as you've been writing about over the last, you know, number of years, that there's a real urgency to these times. And now people, you know, like when you look at it, it has everything to do with what's on the agenda, what's possible to come out of this. And when you look at what's going on now, there's this question that people, you know, there's the situation in Iraq, there's the increased repression, there's this, people look at themselves as confronted with, and I've even seen it described as these elections, described as the most important. And sometimes I've heard one person say in the history of humanity, you know, at the very least, people are talking about these elections as the most important in the history of this country, you know. And it's sort of there's a view that the upcoming elections will determine what the future of humanity is, what the future is for us here now, you know. And so with that as their guidepost, a lot of people have been sort of coming into a certain amount, you know, conciliation with the anybody but Bush, with, you know, Kerry, with the Democrats. There's even been people, there's, you know, one person, Medea Benjamin, who said, well, she would find it, she has no problem when people ask her, what do you want to come, you know, what will you be doing the day after the election? And she said, well, if John Kerry wins, the reason I'm behind him is John Kerry wins, then I'll feel a lot better about being out in the streets the day after the election, because at least I know then that somebody will listen to me. And there's, you know, other people have raised that then there's a need to unite with the Democrats now, because this is similar to, you know, opposing the Nazis in Germany, you know, and that there needs to be this united front, that revolutionary-minded people need to put themselves into getting the Democrats in power, defeating these fascist elements with Bush and all that stuff, and then stepping back after that and continuing the struggle against, you know, for social justice. But meanwhile, they've actually said that the main task for any revolutionary-minded person is to get out there now and be registering more people to vote, you know, and to get them out to the polling places when the elections come up. How do you see this? I mean, there's a point. I mean, they're doing all this, and yet Kerry himself is standing there and just sort of slapping him in the face because he's not doing what they're even saying they think he should be doing or he will do. How would you speak to that?
Well, I think that, to begin with, I think that the what people are saying about this is the most important election, whatever, you know, comparison they use. I think the fact they're saying this is an extremely important election is a reflection of what is true, that there are extremely big things up in the society and in the world. There are great stakes to what's happening in the world. That's on the one side. On the other hand, if it's true that the outcome of this election is the most important thing that will happen, you know, for a long time to come, or, you know, in comparison to whatever comparison you want to draw. But the most important thing is what the outcome of this election, we're in a lot of trouble. Because, put in those terms, the outcome of this election, whichever way it goes, is not going to be good. Neither one of these candidates who will be elected, assuming the election goes ahead, is going to do good things. Quite the contrary. So if you've accepted those terms and you're saying the outcome of this election, meaning that Kerry's got to get elected, is the most important thing that's happened in decades, then you're saying we're in a world of trouble. Because if Kerry's elected, good things are not going to happen. Obviously, if Bush is elected, good things are not going to happen. But if Kerry's elected, good things are not going to happen. So that's one point. There's a difference between saying there are great stakes, there's a tremendous amount at stake here, and saying is that should be reduced to the question of who wins the election. Those are very different things, just as the first point. Now, to amplify that, let's take, you know, what you quoted from Medea Benjamin. In other words, what makes you think that Kerry, who hasn't listened to you all this time, when he, quote-unquote, needs your vote, is going to listen to you once elected, if he were elected? In other words, he hasn't yielded anything in the direction of what people who are protesting against the Iraq war and you know, for other progressive causes, so on. You know, he hasn't yielded anything to that, particularly around the question of war. And you know, he's made his whole case based on he can do a better job of prosecuting this war. He'll be a better commander-in-chief, and he has openly and explicitly, he and the Democratic Party, formulated their platform in those terms. It's a very bellicose, you know, war-oriented platform, and they've accepted and taken up the challenge of proving that the real issue is who can be the better commander-in-chief explicitly. So they're not making any concessions to the things you're talking about now. Why would you think they would do so after getting elected? Even by your own logic, if they're going to make concessions to you, that now would be the time to do it, so you'd vote for them. And I know the logic, well, they have to appeal to blah, 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 but they have to appeal to the center, so they have to say other things. But even by that logic, once they're elected, the same reality's there. Why would they then listen to you rather than the people that they appeal to get elected? Because then there's always the question of getting reelected. And once you accept this logic, which is really illusory, it's not really what the reality is, and it's not really what the dynamics are and how these things really unfold and get decided. But once you accept it, then you're trapped within it. And in fact, it doesn't correspond to what you think you can get out of it. So, you know, this is fundamentally an illusion. And the only reality that it speaks to is that to a constantly decreasing degree, the Democrats pretend to listen to people like Medea Benjamin, whereas the Republicans don't even pretend to do that. That's the real substantial difference, is one of them doesn't listen but pretends to. And I mean, listen in the sense of acting on the basis of what people, even through mass pressure, would bring forward as an argument. To the degree that they are susceptible to that pressure, so is that's the degree to which the ruling class as a whole is susceptible to that pressure. You know, we've seen plenty of examples of that. I mean, you go back to Nixon. Nixon was a defender of affirmative action. You know, people forget that. But, you know, 30 years ago, Nixon was a defender of affirmative action because that was the terms of things in those days. That's the way things shaped up in the society. So, you know, you wouldn't think that that would be the case, but it actually was. And he was probably more staunch advocate of affirmative action than the Democrats are now. So, you know, this is the motion and development of things. So that's, you know, on that level, it's an illusion to think that they're going to listen to you. They're not basing what they're doing on the rational arguments or the cogency of the arguments of people out there in the populace. They're doing it on what they see are the interests of the system that they are elected to represent and have no choice but to represent if they are elected, because that's what they step into. That's the system they step into. Those are the dynamics that they have to deal with. So in fundamental terms, it's an illusion to think that a Kerry is going to listen to you any more than a Bush does. A Bush will. He may pretend a little more, but that's not the same thing as actually listening to you. More fundamentally than that, people have to break out of the illusion once again that the way the decision making in a society goes, and this is the more left version of it, I think, is that the elite in society picks a few people, and then you can influence in turn what's done by which one of those that the elites has picked you decide to vote for. And really, that's, first of all, on the most, you know, sort of minimal level, you're accepting the idea that you have, that those are the only choices. And that, you know, the ruling forces or elite or powers that be, or however you see it, make, you know, come up with these selections and offer you these alternatives, and the most you can do is choose among them and try to pressure the one or the other, which you feel is more amenable to you, or more amenable to your pressure, okay? So that's one thing. But then if you go on with it further, as you know, you're not understanding A, the real way in which decisions are made, and B, the real role of elections. That the decisions are made not through the process of elections, but through the process in which things are struggled out among the ruling class. And you know, you do have contending forces, and right now it's very obvious and relatively sharp. You have contending sections of the ruling class battling things out. But let's look at what are the actual terms on which they're battling it out. Not the terms you want to pretend or imagine that they're arguing about, or that you can somehow mystically or magically make be the terms that they're contending over, but what are the actual terms they're contending over? They're contending precisely over how to wage the war on terror, as they call it, which is really a war for empire, and how to carry out the necessary repression in relationship to that, and to what degree do we need allies in that process, and to what degree do we need to talk about constitutional rights in that context while we're trampling on them. These are the things they're battling out, and it gets concentrated over this question, and as they explicitly formulated, including the Democrats and Kerry, who is the better commander-in-chief? So you want you want this to be a referendum on war, and it is all right, but not the way you want it, you, the people who oppose war, impose what these imperialists are doing in Iraq and so on. They're making it a referendum on war in the sense of who can be the better commander-in-chief. Not what you'd like it to be, should we have a whole imperial policy or imperial approach to the world like this. So you can't superimpose your, you can, but it's harmful to superimpose your illusions about what this election's about on what it really is about. And the terms of it are decided by those people who put the candidates there in the first place, by their funding, by the way the media defines who's a legitimate candidate, and who all of a sudden has become illegitimate. Even Howard Dean got ruled illegitimate at a certain point early in this process. I mean, it was interesting. California, which is the most populous state in the country, moved its primary up to early March, so precisely so that its primary would not be irrelevant, and yet it was irrelevant. Because the media and the Democratic Party hacks declared, even before you got to the biggest primary in the whole country, or before New York, which is the second biggest one, they declared that the election was over. The primary was over before those primaries even. So what does that tell you? Kerry was in, and it's the irony, is that California moved up its primary precisely to avoid that, and yet it happened anyway. So what does that tell you? That even a Howard Dean got ruled out of order. What it tells you is how decision-making really goes on. That in the real corridors of power, where the money comes from, where the financing of campaigns come from, and where the media are controlled, yes, with a lot of struggle about what the character of that media should be, between the conservative imperialist, or the fascist type imperialist, if you want, and the more mainstream centrist imperialist. Yes, there's struggle. But through that struggle, and through the finances, and through the media, who is a legitimate candidate, and what are legitimate issues are defined and delimited. And then they tell you within that framework you can vote for the one and the other. So first of all, you don't even get to choose the issues or the candidates that frame things the way you'd like them to be framed. Second of all, even though you get to vote, by the same process before you vote that they limit and constrain and confine and channel things, they do the same thing afterward. In other words, they don't abide by the results of the election in the way you think you're voting for things. They shape the election and then proceed on from the election to deal with the issues that come up and to shape the limit, the options for the president, etc., in the same way they shape the options for the election in the first place. And that's what people have to come to understand. This is a process that's controlled by a ruling class, and yes, it's struggling, and are struggling, even intense struggle within its ranks, but it's within a certain framework, which is not the framework in which things can be affected to move them in the direction in which really lies with the interests of the majority of society and certainly the majority of humanity, in which progressive people want to see them move. So this is, you have to break out of the, it's sort of like you accept their framework and then invent an idea about what you can do within that framework, which doesn't have anything to do with the reality of it. That's the first point. Now, as far as this sort of pseudo-left idea of, we got to vote the fascists out. Look, I don't think it's wrong to we refer to this Christian fundamentalist movement that's part of the whole Bush camp as a Christian fascist. I don't think it's wrong to character for overstating or hyperbole to call these people fascists. I do think there's contention in the ruling class, I think there's even a real question of whether this section of the ruling class that let's call fascists, grouped around Bush and others, will even allow themselves to be voted out of office. If they think that might happen, whether they'll even allow election to go on, or this whole thing has come up around the voting machines. And now, you know, there's not a lot of paper trail. You can actually trace down what happened. And, you know, they seem to have some control over some of these election machines in key states. So, that, you know, there are a lot of ways. We've seen it in 2000. They could easily... So the idea that somehow, you know, by voting, you can... If they're determined to stay in power, then thinking that voting for Kerry is going to get them out is an illusion. You know, the way that you would get them out within the confines of the system would be if there were a powerful section of the ruling class, and particularly one in them that had strong connections in the military, that wanted to oust them and could actually mobilize the forces to do it. Once you were talking about just within the bourgeois framework, but merely voting, you know, for Kerry in greater numbers, even if you accept those terms, is no guarantee that Bush would be forced out of office. If they're fascists. And they're already in there, and then there's a danger they're going to be voted out, quote unquote. They may just shut down the election through one pretense or another, including fabricating a terrorist incident themselves if there isn't one ready to happen, or just declaring that election results null and void, declaring irregularities, and going to the Supreme Court and having the Supreme Court say the election has to be put off for any number of years, or mobilizing the military to say too bad. So if you really think those are the terms, we better do something radically different than voting for Kerry. We better build mass resistance that's prepared to carry on in the face of something of an attempted fascist coup, that's prepared to introduce a whole different dynamic into this, that doesn't say, I'll feel better the day after because Kerry's there, but says whoever's there the day after, we better be challenging and disrupting, in political terms, the whole the dynamic and the whole logic and the whole terms in which this is cast now, and introducing increasingly a whole different terms into this. And I also think this goes a little bit back to one of our earlier discussions about bring forward the base of society, and what I was saying a little bit about that earlier. If there were, and to the degree there becomes, a force of even thousands, and then increasing numbers, of people coming from that base of society who represent a radically different revolutionary alternative to this, I think that's going to begin to change the terms among progressive people in the more middle strata who are getting caught up in all this. So going back to what I said at the beginning, I understand why people feel very strongly about this, and I understand why they're pulled in this direction. But really what we need is to pose and to bring into being powerfully our dynamic versus their dynamic. Their dynamic is one in which they make the decisions, they present us the alternatives, and in which only the struggle among them, the power struggle to the degree that and in the forms that it goes on among them, determines the direction of society. And our voting is only in relation to that, and has no fundamental effect on that. That's their dynamic. And it is a very dangerous one. Or there's our dynamic where we bring forward mass resistance, and who's ever there, we broaden and deepen that resistance and develop the means with which it can withstand the heightening repression that's going to come no matter who's in the White House. And can withstand even the repression that's going to come in the context where they cancel the elections, for example. But it's developing, even in an embryonic way, but in a rapid and telescope way, the forms and means to still call forth resistance in the face of that. That's the dynamic. That's where all our energy should be going. Now, we don't make the dividing line whether you're going to vote or not. We make a dividing line whether you're going to be part of building that resistance or not, and whether you really carry through and do that. But as a matter of actual reality, it is necessary for people to begin to rupture with this notion that these decisions get made by how we cast our votes. I mean, this is just accepting the terms that they want us to be limiting ourselves to see things in. And it is paralyzing to the degree that people accept those terms and think that their options are limited or essentially defined by, or find their only framework and context within choosing the one or the other. We have to build a movement that ruptures out of that. And some people who vote and many people who don't both have to be involved in creating that whole different dynamic and consciously seeing themselves politically in battle, in a very decisive battle with this whole system and the whole ruling class. Whether or not you think communism is the answer at this point is something can be ongoing struggle about. But certainly I think the reason people are feeling so pulled toward voting for Kerry, despite everything Kerry's revealing himself to be, is that they do realize that there's a whole thing that we're up against that has great power at the top. They're just not seeing it in the fully correct terms. And they're not seeing, more importantly, the actual dynamic of what's going on. And a dynamic we have to challenge and rupture things out of, or contend seriously with, in order to try to set a whole different direction of society, uniting to do that while we struggle about where that all goes, how fundamentally it needs to go to the root of things, and what's the alternative to it, and how to get to that, and what forces you have to bring forward and unite to do that. All that are things we need to struggle over, but we need to unite to bust out of this dynamic. And, you know, I also see the irony, for example, in this whole spectacle of Bill Maher on his show, you know, with Michael Moore going down on their knees in a very dramatic way, begging Nader not to run. Because it's just, once again, an expression of this illusion that somehow, you know, if Nader doesn't run, then Bush will get voted out and it'll avert the whole thing that Bush represents. Well, it's interesting if you look at Nader's answer to that. What Nader says is, you know, if you actually, the more I'm in there, the more it's possible it's going to be to beat Bush. And the reason he argues that, and on a certain level he has a certain logic, which is that only if Bush is challenged in the way that I'm challenging him, only if I come in from sort of the left of Kerry and bring all this up, will people actually be motivated to vote against Bush. And not only to vote, but to get other people out to vote against Bush in a way that will actually succeed in defeating him in the election. And on a certain level, there's a certain logic to that. Because Kerry's program, while people may hold their nose and vote for him, does not inspire and motivate and activate people to bring out a lot more people to vote, even though there's some of that. It doesn't do it nearly to the breadth and depth it would if he really took a position like Nader, even if one Nader's arguing for, as limited and reformist as that is. But the deeper irony is that Nader is wrong on a more fundamental level. He's wrong because Kerry cannot run that way. And more than that, Kerry and the Democratic Party do not want the challenge posed to Bush the way Nader wants to pose it, even though posing it that way would mobilize more of a base of people to in turn mobilize more to vote against Bush. But the Democrats and Kerry don't want to mobilize people in that way. They don't want them. Not only do they not want to do it, they don't want others doing it. They don't want that kind of a critique set, you know, and those kind of terms being brought into the arena. It's interesting. It reminds me when I saw a video of Robin Williams performing for Clinton in the mid-90s. And he was telling all these, you know, anti-Republican jokes and getting at some of their real and I've never seen Robin Williams so flat. And the reason he was so flat is because, they're, you know, how good you are does depend ultimately on what your audience is doing out there. Mm-hmm. And these jokes were very biting jokes, getting at some things, not the heart, but the some things about what the Republicans are about. But Clinton and the other people who were his audience were not the least bit interested in that kind of a critique of the Republicans and didn't share it. They shared much more in common with the Republicans than even the things Robin Williams was bringing forward as biting satire and exposing them. And it was just, he was completely flat, you know, in a way I've never seen him before. And that also speaks to something I'm getting at here, that you think that you can make the Democrats be what you want them to be, or even more fundamentally, you think you can make this process what you want it to be, but you can't. This is a process that's defined by the people who run it and by the system that these people serve and in which this is all grounded. And accepting those terms means that you won't be out in the street in a bigger way, even if Kerry wins, because there's a logic that goes along with that. And what are you going to do if you find out Kerry doesn't listen to you? You know, are you then just going to throw up your hands? And whether or not Medea Benjamin as an individual does, a lot of people will do that. If that's the, even well-intentioned people, if that's the logic to which they're wedded and in which they're, within which they're confined, they will then get demoralized rather than angrier and more active if they've been conditioned and trained to accept that this is the framework, this is the logic, and this is the dynamic we have to accept.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
This has been a lot of fun.
An amazing trip, man.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, welcome back. And that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. All right, we want to take your calls for the rest of the hour, and that's 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. And if you've been listening, the reason I even referred to that as an amazing trip is, like I said, this has been this was a very extensive interview. It took place over a period of hours, maybe 5 hours of interview, and I plan on running excerpts on that over the many throughout the months to come, the next few months. So we will be getting a schedule out about when those interviews will run, and it's based on a lot of the questions that you, the listeners, actually ask me every time we talk about this. What could the future world be? What would things look like?